Well, a big thanks to Darren and the team for driving us through the afternoon. It is Thursday, April 3rd. I'm Shane Dawson and you are listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the new music show with Beto Da Silva at 7pm, Paul Corry chats football. Tony O'Donoghue dials in from Crete ahead of Ireland's Women's Nations League clash with Greece. Bernard Jackman previews the weekend's Champions Cup rugby action, while Shane McGrath looks forward to the National Hurling League finals. Jeff Shepherd has his eye on America, and Austin O'Malley pays tribute to the late great Mick O'Dwyer. If you want to get in touch, you can WhatsApp 087 187 9200, text 51552, or find us on X at GameOn2FM.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome along to the show. It is great to have your company wherever in the world you are tuning in from. Lots to get through between now and 7 o'clock. Lots of big news today. We will be speaking to Austin O'Malley very shortly on the passing of the late, great Mick O'Dwyer. Paul Corry joins us in studio. Paul, lots to get through in football, review and preview in the Premier League, and looking forward to the return of the UEFA Women's Nations League.
Yeah, I think everybody involved with the game is. Shane, particularly given how the Carlow Awards last two games went, the results were one thing, the performances was another bit of a worry, I think, for that squad. So to put that to bed and to focus on the Greece games, I think, is a welcome distraction for Carlow Ward and the side. And listen, it's a really good opportunity to bounce back against a Greece team that we'd be expected to beat. There'll obviously be a bit of chopping and change, and I would expect she'll probably shift personnel maybe into different positions. I think it's more likely Katie will probably revert back towards maybe a left wing back or a left wing position, and let's see what sort of 11 Carla Ward goes with, because one thing is for certain, there'll be changes off the back of the Slovenia game, because there was moments in that game, I thought, Shane, in particular, where we looked really exposed.
Yeah, very much so. Wasn't ideal. And even just grinding out a 1-0 victory in Tala against Turkey, and we were all kind of going into that thinking Turkey way down in the rankings, Ireland currently 26, Greece in 61st place, so 35 places between the teams. We will be previewing that a little bit later on. Tony O'Donoghue is going to join us from Crete as well. 3 o'clock kickoff for that one tomorrow afternoon, 3 o'clock Irish time that is, with coverage and commentary on the RT player, RT2 television and Radio 1. Extra for your radio coverage. However, we are turning our attention to racing, because Willie Mullins has pulled off an extraordinary Grade 1 four-timer on day one of the Aintree Grand National Meeting. Mullins saddled the winners of the first four races on the card, the pick of them in the feature, the Aintree Hurdle, in which his star mare Lossiemouth just prevailed in the hands of jockey Paul Townend after a good battle to the line with Woodoo. We can hear from Willie Mullins now after that victory for Lossiemouth.
Tremendous performance. She was good. You know, we thought the step up to 2.5 would suit her under these conditions. But knowing Nico and the way Nico rides, I thought, oh no, Nico is going to pounce again with maybe half a furlong to run. And then unfortunately for Nico, the horse caught the top of it and fell over, you know. But that's what I was afraid of, that he'd come back and steal it off us.
Now, the other story of that race was the fall of Constitution Hill for the second time in two big races, having fallen in the Cheltenham Champion Hurdle last month. This time, Constitution Hill fell two fences from home while being ridden by Nico de Boinville. So worrying for Constitution Hill in that regard. The other three Mullins winners were Imperé Pass in the Grade 1 Novices Chase, Mercia in the Juvenile Hurdle, both ridden by Townend, who had a three-timer. And the fourth Mullins winner was Gaelic Quarry in the Aintree Bowl, that one ridden by Patrick Mullins. And just on racing news, looking ahead, defending Aintree Grand National Champion Ian Maximus heads the 34 Maximum Final Field Declarations for Saturday's Grand National at Aintree. The Shark Hanlon trained Hewick third last year, and winner of the King George the Sixth Chase in 2023 is also in the final field.
Game On. Gaelic football.
But headline news today, and very sad news indeed. Mick O'Dwyer, the legendary Kerry Gaelic football manager and player, has died at the age of 88. Throughout a 57-year inter-county career as player and manager, O'Dwyer rewrote the history books and arguably changed the face of Gaelic football. He won 4 All-Irelands as a player and a further 8 as the manager of a brilliant Kerry team in the 1970s and 80s, whose rivalry with Dublin came to define an era of Gaelic football. The Waterfell native won 23 Munster titles and 11 National Leagues as player and manager, helping to establish Kerry as the dominant force in the country. Over the course of his 33-year involvement with his native county, O'Dwyer had a hand in almost one-third of Kerry's 37 All-Ireland titles since 1903. Absolutely incredible. The Kingdom have won 7 in the 33 years since he stood down as manager in 1989. Having stepped away from Kerry, O'Dwyer enjoyed a remarkable later career managing Kildare, Laois, Clare and Wicklow. And on that note, Austin O'Malley joins us on the line. Austin, sad news for all involved with Gaelic football, an absolute legend of the game, and one you had personal experience with during your time at Wicklow.
Yeah, no, look, obviously when the news broke this morning, I think it was probably a bit of a thump to the heart to anyone that knew Mikko or that kind of served under him. But I was just so fortunate and blessed to spend that last season of 2011 under his kind of guidance and tutelage. And it's just sad, obviously, to hear, you know, that he passed today, and just even what you're after calling out there to understand the fingerprints that he's had, you know, on so much success with Kerry, with Laois, with Kildare and with Wicklow. But just an iconic figure. He was such a big character, like, you know, and I always said he had just such gravitas and magnetism, like, you know, that he just had that ability to draw you in when he spoke. And he was just such a legendary figure of the game, and, like, arguably, I would say, you know, the greatest GA manager of all time in terms of, you know, what he has done and where he has done it and how he's carried himself throughout, like. And it's just, I suppose, it's phenomenal what he's done, and incredible to think that he's passed, and the legacy that he's left behind. I don't know if it'll ever be outshone or outdone, you know.
Yeah, so many people have so many links, and even to add to the couple of stats that I was giving out there, and even reading them, I was nearly taken away by just the achievements that he throughout his whole career as a player and a manager. And also that fact that I read about a while ago, and I saw on Twitter today, the 2024 championship was the first since 1948 not to feature a player that played with, who would go on to play with or played under Mick O'Dwyer following Cathal O'Connor's retirement with Clare. Like Austin, what were your personal experiences of Mick O' the manager, and also of Mick O' the person?
I think they were obviously so entwined, and, like, today is a day probably reflecting and reminiscing with different lads, but personally, I think it was just his ability to connect with people was far beyond maybe what I would have experienced before in from different managers and so on. And I think he had that unique ability. Like, there's probably a lot of homage paid to kind of emotional intelligence now in managers, and it's a new kind of word that's sort of gaining traction maybe within coaching and that and different stuff. But I think Mikko had that in abundance when nobody ever knew about it, that ability to really connect, I think, with just the player's heart and mind. And often said, like, you know, 5 minutes with Mikko was better than 5 hours with a sports psychologist, because you just came away, felt, you know, he had the ability to lift people up and energize people, and just those small conversations, the power of those. And he was so, I think, you know, authentic in his nature, but he was also a man that had a brilliant coaching craft. And, you know, he was a guy that, you know, as I said, he'd arrive early to train. And I remember, you know, nights in Wicklow, you'd arrive really early yourself, but Mickey would always be there ahead of you. And, you know, he'd connect with everybody. He'd have a word for everyone. And, you know, there was a lot of things that Mikko done for an awful lot of people away from the game as well, and helped them with different things as well. So it was his ability, I think, to build relationships, really connect with people's hearts and minds. And I think what really came across with Mikko was that he was just obsessed about the game, and the levels of commitment that he brought to it was extraordinary. When you think of even, you know, his term in Wicklow, like, drive, you know, from Waterville to Wicklow, the drive. And, you know, he really didn't see anything wrong with that. He was so committed and so focused, and I think that came across to players. And, you know, there was one night I remember we were drilling up in Roundwood, a real, real cold night in the depths of winter, and I remember there was maybe one or two guys missing training. And I remember him, he just pulled us in and he said, like, I suppose his mentality was, you know, there was no earthly reason in the world that you should miss training outside of maybe a member of your family being deceased or so on. And he had an uncanny way of wrapping a message with emotion and delivering it. And I remember we just sort of broke, and I just sort of hit me. I thought, wow, you know, that's pretty hardcore, that's deep. But that was his psyche, that was his nature, and that was the level of I suppose commitment and obsession he had about the game. And you know, I think one of his great autobiography, I still have it on the shelf and I often go back to it, but it was called Blessed and Obsessed. I think it was written with Martin Breheny a number of years ago, 2000, early 2000 or mid 2000s, and there's so much in that. But I think it was just so aptly named that he always felt he was blessed to be from Kerry, but he was obsessed about the game and he'd go to any lengths to be involved in it. And to nurture and coach those as well that were under his guidance.
Mm. Were you involved in one of his last games, the famous replay against Armagh and Ockram after drawing the previous week?
Yeah, I was, and that was like, again, that was incredible. Like we went up to Armagh, like probably rank outsiders. It was a hell of a game. It was probably one of the best games I've ever been involved with. It was such end-to-end stuff. It was a draw after full-time. It went to extra time. We drew after extra time. I think Aaron Kiernan came in off his left and kicked the equaliser in injury time off extra time. And we brought them back to Ockram. And they beat us in Ockram the following week. But I remember distinctly just even that day, up in Armagh, like Mikko's halftime. Now he was a good man to absolutely, you know, raise the temperature when he needed. But I remember particularly that day up in Armagh at halftime, like where he turned, like he was after giving a kind of a rousing speech to get us going again, and he turned and he just kind of drew the shoe on the table and sent it down the floor. Like, and it was just one of those moments where you could see, wow, this is a guy that has done so much in the game, that has achieved so much. And here he is, you know, with us in Wicklow up here in Armagh, and he's still so vigorously passionate. He's still such a competitor and he's still living it. Like, so, you know, it's just, it's very hard to get that from other individuals and to see that level of passion and that level of commitment and just his ferocity in terms of his competitive nature as well.
Just briefly, Austin, before I let you go, what traits from Mick O'Dwyer's management have you taken in your own management career?
I think the big thing that you would take from Mick, and I certainly, is the absolute commitment and focus and concentration on your brief when you get it, and the passion and the energy that you need to bring to every session. And also, I think just the other bit that I mentioned maybe at the top there, the idea of that, you know, management and football, it's all about people and getting the best out of people. But in order to do that, you have to have the ability to connect with people's maybe, as I often say, with their hearts and minds. And I think that was Mikko's really, really brilliant skill in terms of being able to develop people, really get under their skin, find out, you know, kind of what unlocks their potential, and to find a common ground with them. And, you know, I think Mikko had that, and he had like the ability to do that and connect, as I said. But he's a very successful man, obviously, in business and in life outside of football as well. So I think those are the skills and the attributes that definitely I would have, you know, that you would take from Mikko, from what I suppose observed and tried to absorb from my time under his tutelage.
Yeah, an absolutely larger than life character. Austin O'Malley, thank you so much for taking the phone call. Morris Brosnan, a writer with the Irish Examiner, actually had a beautiful tweet. Wishy Fogarty told a story in his glorious book about a trial game in 1968 that changed the fact of Kerry football. It was a Kerry past versus Kerry present. The past won. Jackie Lyon persuaded three of them to return afterwards. That trial game was played at the request of one of them, Mick O'Dwyer. So on that note, we are taking a short ad break and turning our attention to football. Tony O'Donoghue joins us live from Crete. Paul Corry is still with us, and we'll hear from Republic of Ireland manager Carla Ward.
Game on.
Association football.
Now, the Irish women's national team are back in Nations League action tomorrow in Crete. 3 o'clock kickoff, Irish time. Let's hear from their manager now, Carla Ward.
I've been really clear to the group. We have to come here, we have to get 3 points. That's the bottom line. And I don't think anything but 3 points is good enough. And that's being honest. So we have to come here and react. But listen, they've reacted so well this week. They really have. They've been unbelievable these last few days. And I told them that last night. And it's important to recognise that how they've reacted. And yeah, they've been really good.
You talked about maybe making some tweaks. Will there be a change of shape to the team, or are you looking for a new balance in the team?
It's more of a tactical tweak. It's more of a how do we stop transitions, because we didn't do that well enough against Slovenia. So there's been a couple of tweaks that we've done, particularly one, what it looks like behind the ball when we've got the ball, but also how we react and where we react when we lose the ball. So it's more of a tactical tweak than a shape tweak.
And you've got to be looking at winning this group, don't you?
Yeah, listen, it's going to be tough, right? Because we've obviously, that defeat in Slovenia, we probably need Turkey to take some points from Slovenia today. That would be nice. But look, we can only do what we can do. We'll do our very best with that.
Carla Ward speaking to Tony O'Donoghue, who joins us on the line from Crete. Tony, I can imagine it is very warm in Crete at the moment ahead of this match tomorrow. And what is the atmosphere like? Because it was a bit of a mixed bag in the first block of games.
More than a mixed bag, I think it was really disappointing, the first couple of games. Yes, we beat Turkey 1-0 in Tala, but far from convincing. The goal came like 3 minutes into added time in the first half, and we kind of lost our way, and Turkey had a really good chance near the end of the 90 minutes, and we might have, you know, dropped the whole game. So, you know, that was a bit of a worry. And then to go to Slovenia, and these are teams now that we're ranked much higher than, and there was a complete system failure there. Now, there was only one change in the lineup. Amber Bard came in for Shiva, which shifted Kira Caruso out of position. But then Megan Campbell got injured in the warm-up, you'll remember, and that seemed to mess up the heads of the management. It seemed to mess up the players. It seemed to really affect them, because Mannion moved to left full-back, and now she's a right-footer playing on the left. Megan Connolly came in for Megan Campbell, and she went to centre-half. Now, she has played in centre-half before as part of a three, but we kind of know her more as a midfielder. And, you know, Katie McCabe moved a bit further forward. We've often said, is that what's going to be her best position? But it really, really messed with our heads. And we were caught with balls over the top. You heard Carla there talking about being caught in transition. It really was a system failure. And, you know, the stats of the game say one thing, you know. Total attempts by Ireland, 27 versus 9 for Slovenia. Ireland had 14 corners to 2 for Slovenia. The only statistic that really counts, Slovenia 4, Ireland 0. So, like, it's something to be really concerned about, and really we have to see a reaction in this game tomorrow.
I can imagine for certain individuals there will be a case of point to prove.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, there has been some additions to the squad. It's great to see Chloe Mustaki back in the squad. Evene Clancy from Shelburne being called up as well is a great boost for her and Shelburne and the League of Ireland. And it's great to see Saoirse Noonan coming back as well. Like, you know, she made her senior debut in 2016 against Wales. But this is her first involvement for 2 years. And she's been in the Champions League with Celtic. She scored 3 goals in 9 Champions League games. She scored 23 goals in the Scottish Women's Premier League for Celtic and 2 in the Scottish Women's Cup. And Carla did say that, you know, pity Saoirse Noonan wasn't around for those 27 attempts at goal in Slovenia. And then, of course, there's Amber Barrett. And, you know, I've spoke to her the other day. She really is a very honest person. We all remember Amber for that special Irish moment she had, getting the goal in Hampden Park against Scotland, which drove Ireland on to the first ever World Cup. And so she'll always be remembered for that, in the same way that, you know, Ray Houghton will be remembered or Robbie Brady will be remembered. She'll have that, but she wants a bit more than that, of course, and she has to get on the pitch in order to do that. So, you know, in speaking to her, she reflected on her time in a green shirt, but she also talked to me about that game against Slovenia and what that 4-0 defeat meant to her and the rest of the squad.
I think that if I was Slovenian, I would have been delighted with, I think, what they saw in terms of our positioning at times and the space, because we looked at the fact that they were good on the counter-attack and we had to make sure we closed off the spaces. And it just, look, it is, everything went wrong. And I think the gaps in certain positions were too big, and teams are better now. You know, like the Slovenian striker, Praznikar, plays with Frankfurt. Like, she's a very, very good player, like, has been dominating Bundesliga for a long time. So it's not that they're just a Slovenian team with average players. They have a lot of good quality players. And I think we knew that going into the game. Like, I don't think it was a case of we undermined them. But I think there was elements of we needed to be an even better version of ourselves to get results and dominate the game. And I think we did better with it in the second half. But I think in any type of game, you can't be 3-0 down at half time. Like, it's unforgivable. And I think now the teams, like if I was any of the other teams in the group, I'd be looking saying, look, we can go at Ireland, so we have to now respond with Friday and Tuesday with good results and good performances to show the teams that, you know, it happened, but we've dealt with it and we're moving on. So I think that's the only way you can deal with these types of situations. You know, at top international football, like if you're given gaps and spaces to players of any level, they will hurt you. And I think that's exactly what Slovenia did, and miss, you know, conceding fouls and giving away the ball under no pressure, like missing 5 yard, 6 yard passes. Like you cannot excuse that. And I think that, you know, you can look at it holistically from, oh, tactically maybe we didn't do the right thing or all these things, but you also have to look at it individually. Was, did I do the job I was asked to do? And if you can, if anybody can turn around and say, yeah, I did my job, there's also that element of it, then you need the people around you to be doing it. And I think it just didn't happen, and the reasoning why, I don't know, but it's something that we have to look at, learn from and move on from.
You can't do much of a job from the bench, though, apart from plead with the coach to put you on. I mean, how frustrating has it been for you with the goals that you're scoring at club level to not be starting?
I think I've had a mixed approach with it. I think that there's definitely been camps that have come in, felt really good, felt confident. I felt like I've had good weeks in training and obviously didn't get, I suppose, game time, didn't get either starting the game or coming on, and I find that really hard to deal with. And it's funny because I spoke to the sports psychologist in the Irish team the last couple of camps ago, and you know, she had said something to me about that when your values are impacted, you get frustrated. So like for me, like, you know, if somebody's training well, like to reward the fairness of somebody who's doing well, and I felt like that's not always happened with me, and I don't know what it is, and it's just, again, something I've just learned to deal with, and it's very hard to deal with it all the time if it keeps happening. But I also think there's other side of it where I'm like, well, you did have a good Monday, Tuesday, but Wednesday, Thursday, you weren't as good as you should have been. And, you know, I don't always put fault on coaches, because I think sometimes it's very easy to just say, you didn't play me, you didn't play me. Mm-hmm. Whereas I look at myself, Tony, and going to Standard has been without doubt one of the best decisions I've ever made, because I have that confidence of scoring goals again. I have that value in a team where they look at me and they're like, you are important for us. And I have that feeling amongst myself, and I can drive standards and I can try and improve things. And, you know, there was questions about the standard of the league and all this stuff, and I was like, it's nonsense. I'm playing every week, I'm scoring goals. Like, what more do you want me to do? Like, and I think you have to look at it like that. And I still feel like I have loads to give for Ireland, and I want to keep working, I want to keep pushing. I want to keep being a thorn in people's side and saying, well, if I'm not going to start Friday, I'm going to be in your team on Tuesday, like whatever the way it is. And I think I just have that determination to keep pushing, keep, I think, I don't like the phrase proving people wrong, but I think it's more proving myself right. Mm. And I've built up a very hard shell over a long time of, you know, been in and out of teams and in and out of squads, that I think that, you know, it's not a comfortable place to get, being like, oh, I know how to deal with this. You know, I don't really want to be dealing with it for the rest of my career, that I'm always, I suppose, the one that misses out when, you know, I feel like I could have had an opportunity. But I think everything happens for a reason. And I always believe it's how you respond to situations. It's not what happens, it's how you respond to them. And I think I have a good head on my shoulders that I, 9 times out of 10, respond the right way. I like to channel my energy in the right way, and I think that it is good to be hurt, it's good to be frustrated, because again, as long as you put it into the right thing and not sitting pointing fingers at people and, you know, deflecting blame, you have to put that on yourself and say, do you know what, we're going to go out today and we're going to cause so much problems for everybody. And that's sometimes that's what you have to do. You have to cause problems for defenders. You have to, you know, if Carol is looking at training, I have to be like, well, I scored 25 goals today, so like, what do you want me to do? So I think that's just always the mindset, is just to be a thorn in people's side and be constantly giving them, look what I'm doing, what you're asking me to do. So yeah, I think I'm growing from that as well. I'm learning how to deal with it better.
And what has she said to you? Obviously she can't give you any guarantees, mm-hmm. but I mean, you've obviously broached this with her.
I don't think that you can ever give guarantees, but for me, like, I think, and this is, I've had this conversation with nearly every coach I've had, I've always been like, be honest with me. If I'm not doing something that you want me to do, you have to tell me, like, because I can't sit there guessing. And I think it's been nice with Carla that, you know, that she spoke to me a lot last camp and, you know, had said, like, you know, training's been going well and, you know, you've deserved to start against Slovenia, like, you've earned it. And I felt like I appreciate the fact that she's come to me to tell me this, but also has said to me in training what was good, but also said, like, the press, like, this is where you can get better at the press, and just things like that there, that it's not just all fill me with loads and loads and loads of compliments. You also need to be criticised in the sense of something you can work on. And I think it's just, it has been very refreshing so far. And again, there's no guarantees for Friday or Tuesday, but the guarantee I have to myself is that I'm going to do as much during the week to ask as many questions to cause problems for you when you're selecting the team. And after that, that's all I can do.
Some very raw honesty there, Tony. I can imagine for anyone listening in, any fans of Irish football, refreshing honesty.
Yeah, it's great to hear a player kind of give of herself in an interview. I mean, she's a very intelligent woman, clearly, very honest person, very articulate person. I have to say, that night in Scotland, after she got us to the World Cup and then dedicating that goal to the victims of the Chrysler tragedy, you know, she showed such poise in that moment as well. So she's a quality person. But, you know, she's on the eve of her field cap now. If she doesn't start tomorrow, will she get on, or will she start on Tuesday in the double header against? But, you know, she was brought on in the playoff against Wales. She was unused in the playoff before that against Georgia. She came off the bench against Turkey. She started against Slovenia. But as I said earlier, that game didn't go according to plan. Everyone seemed to be out of kilter in that one. So tomorrow's a big day for Amber Barr. Tomorrow's a big day for the Republic of Ireland, I think.
It most certainly is. Paul Corry, just to wrap up our women's national team chat, just on that point, tomorrow is a massive day for the women's national team, given again of how that went and the coming up against lower ranked opposition. Complacency cannot come into it whatsoever.
Yeah, absolutely. And in an ideal world, Shane, you play well and you pick up the 3 points. But I think for Carla Ward, just winning the game will be the most important thing, if she can, you know, go on the road and then bring that performance back to Ireland next week. It's maybe something to build on. But what you can't afford is a hangover from the last two games. And to Tony's point around kind of transitions and being very exposed when we turned over possession of the ball, I think that has to be eradicated. It was too many times when we played Slovenia in the last fixture. We just looked like there was gaps everywhere, very easy to get at us and create chances. So I guess putting those mistakes to the side and hoping you can be a little bit more ruthless in the final third and see what it is you can muster up from a performance. But result is absolutely, you know, paramount that we get 3 points, put ourselves back in contention within this group.
Okay, great stuff. Tony Donoghue, thank you so much for joining us from Crete. Paul, you're going to stick around for some Premier League chat a little bit later on. As I mentioned, 3 o'clock kickoff Irish time tomorrow, live on RT2 television, the RT player, and Radio 1 Extra. We are taking a short break and then we are going to speak to Jeff Shepherd with his Eye on America.
Game on.
Eye on America.
Now, you're very welcome back to the show. Our eye is on America, American sports only. No mention of tariffs allowed. Jeff Shepherd, we are going to begin by speaking about American football, because the NFL owners meeting took place in Florida this week. What did we learn from that, Shep?
I was told we were going to do 20 minutes on trade policy. No, Shane. So one of the big things that came out from the NFL or the meetings this week was a big discussion about the tush push, you know. And look, if you're longtime listeners to the show, you know what that is. It's the play that the Eagles use to basic, you know, near perfect scoring and first down conversions. Where they line up, you know, one of their running backs right behind Jalen Hurts, and they run up behind him when he gets the ball, and he charges behind the massive Eagles offensive line, and it's virtually unstoppable. And Shane, for some reason, no other team has really been able to mirror the success, even though all of them have running backs and all of them have quarterbacks and all of them have massive people playing on the offensive line of scrimmage. For some reason, the Eagles play is virtually unstoppable. And so the Green Bay Packers, who, you know, lost a game or two to the Eagles last season, once in the regular season and once in the playoffs, have brought up a proposal to eliminate the tush push. And it's being based on player safety. Now, in a game where, you know, 350-pound men charge headfirst into each other 65 times a play, I don't really understand where the player safety argument comes in, but to each his own. I guess that's why they pay these lawyers, you know? And so the league has decided to table the discussion. They want to have some further, you know, talks about it and kind of look it over. I personally just don't understand how we're at this point, Shane. I'm sure if you jumped into your time machine and went back, you know, 75 years to the first time a quarterback threw a pass in what was professional football back then, I'm sure the defense was stunned and didn't really know what to do with themselves. But they adapted and they learned how to play pass defense. I'm kind of at a loss for words here that we need to outlaw this play. If I felt that there was an actual player safety issue, you know, like we have some things we've seen with the kickoffs and just the crazy amount of concussions that are sustained on kickoffs, you know, that would make more sense. I just don't see it here.
It is bizarre that it's only benefiting one team as well, which I think is the broader, I suppose, issue. If it's signaling in on one, and there's similarities, I suppose, with there was changes to Gaelic football because of how certain players or teams were playing it as well. Also coming from that owners' meeting, Shep, and it's interesting, Paul Corrie will be speaking about VAR a little bit later because there was a controversial decision in the Liverpool-Everton match last night where a player should have got sent off, and the video assistant referee, basically, they've come out and apologised and said that there was an issue. The NFL are adding some technology to the process of spotting the ball after a play.
Yeah, so, you know, instant replay has been around in the NFL now for, I guess, it'd be 20 years, if not longer than that. And now they're going to, you know, start using cameras to start spotting the football. I think if this can be done properly, I think it actually will be a benefit to the game. I mean, I've kind of always had issues where you see an official that's supposed to be on the sideline, you know, go to mark the football, and they're 5 yards downfield when the player is tackled. How did they tell, you know, accurately where the football is? It's going to be interesting to see how they work this out, though. You know, I mean, are we going to put, is it just cameras? Are we putting chips in the ball? I mean, you know, you guys know better than anybody else when it comes to this stuff, when you talk about the VAR. You know, I mean, I would love it if it could just be as fast as tennis is, you know, when they go and they make those, you know, reviews. I mean, that happens instantaneously and no one complains and it's just done. You know, it's really easy to see. You know, the more review and the more time you allow, I guess, for humans to kind of sit there and talk things through, you know, I don't know how that benefits the game. So, I mean, I'm assuming, you know, they'll really work this out in the preseason and hopefully, you know, they have it ready to go for week one. But I do think if applied properly, this could benefit the game.
Okay. One last story before we move on to baseball, because there's a baseball story I do want to pick your brain on. This is just a weekly segment at this stage. Aaron Rodgers, watch. Will he be playing in Crow Park, Chef? Come on.
Look, I mean, they keep saying, you know, and look, I mean, I've had marriages that haven't lasted this long, Shane. You know, I mean, these discussions that he's having with these teams, what's going on? I don't, is it a money thing? I mean, look, I think he still physically has the ability to do it. It's just, you know, does one team want to deal with him? Look, the Steelers seem to be the ones that, you know, are allegedly the front runners, you know, for his services this year. But, I mean, it has been a couple of weeks. We've heard some, you know, grumbling from the Steelers locker room saying we're tired of waiting. You know, is this going to happen? Let's go. I mean, you know, getting into April, you're about to start having, you know, team practices and, you know, those types of things. So this probably isn't going to linger much longer. You would think it's going to get wrapped up here pretty soon.
Interesting, actually, just on the tush push, before we move on to baseball, credit to Kev Corcoran, part of our RT Sport team here, who has just messaged me, actually. Richie Gray, the Scottish rugby coach, was involved in creating the tush push and the route into the NFL as well. So there's always a bit of a connection across sports over this side of the water, Shep. However, Major League Baseball, the season started last week and we have learned a new phrase, torpedo bats. What's the story, Shep?
Doesn't that sound awesome? Like, that sounds like...
I like saying it.
Like sounds like some, you know, a tool that some evil guy in a James Bond movie would use, you know, like torpedo bats. But, I mean, so what they are is it's, you know, wooden bats that the baseball players use that distributes the wood of the bat more evenly along the barrel. So typically, you know, you have the handle is smaller, and then, you know, you go towards the top and it's, you know, wider and thicker up there. Well, this is kind of distributing it more evenly in the middle there. And it's, I guess it kind of helps with the like swing leverage and moving the bat through the zone. Well, the Yankees have some players that are using the bats and they hit 9 home runs on Saturday in one game. They actually hit the first 3 pitches of the game for home runs, okay, which is the first time that's ever happened in Major League Baseball history. And so being that it's the Yankees, you know, it kind of got amplified, and it's really been the talk of, you know, the sports world in America here, you know, for the last 5 or 6 days. And, you know, I don't know if they'll outlaw them. I don't know if there's a safety issue there. See, I tied it back to the first story. But we will see, you know, if more teams adopt this. But, you know, I don't know if they didn't use them in the preseason. They just debuted them at the regular season. There's just – it's really a kind of an interesting equipment issue. You know, they're legal. It's just a different twist on, you know, a Major League Baseball bat.
Okay, great stuff. Shep, we'll leave the conversation there. We'll let you get back to stockpiling all your Irish produce. We are taking a short ad break, and then we're chatting to a man who could, I said, he'd make good use of a torpedo bat. Shane McGrath chats hurling after the break.
Game on.
Hurling.
Now, Shane McGrath is on the line looking ahead to Sunday's Division 1A and Division 1B hurling finals. Waterford Offaly meet at 1:45 and Páirc Cuíve Cork before. The big one, Cork against Tipperary at 4 o'clock. Shane McGrath, just how big is the Cork-Tip rivalry?
It has lasted the test of time anyway, Shane. Mm. And, you know, there obviously... As regards winning All-Ireland, you know, Tip of Cork would be up there with Kilkenny, as they were always maybe known as traditional counties, whatever you want to say. But obviously, the likes of Limerick and the Clares of this world have moved into that, moving up towards those brackets now as well. But there's great things that go on between Tip of Cork. There's great banter between the fans, I have to say. Cork love coming to Turles. Tip, never mind going to Páirc Cuíve. It's a rivalry, but I think it's a healthy rivalry, and it goes back down like for a long, long time, I suppose. But even the games we would have had, like my first experience of like a real big game, Páirc Cuíve for me was 2008. Pat Horgan actually made his debut that day, believe it or not, 17 years ago, and the crowd that was there, and there was a crowd nearly out on the sideline, just the terrace. It was so hot. I think people had to come down onto the field nearly, and. You know, it was the old dressing rooms, and the Páirc Cuíve has this Coliseum effect. So all those things added to the rivalry is what I'm trying to say, Shane. Mm. And the games in Turles as well, all the Cork fans come up. So it is a rivalry, but it's a very healthy rivalry. There's great respect between both counties. So it's been a long time since Tip and Cork met in a league final. You have to go back to, I think, is it 1965, was it? Or around then, like. So, you know, it's in recent years, I suppose, Shane, it hasn't been a real busting rivalry because maybe neither of us have been really challenging for All-Irelands. Yeah. But now Cork, they're gone ahead of us now, let's be honest, like, you know, as regards the quality that they have. So I think Tip people are going down hoping that we give a good performance, but maybe also realising the potential of what Cork could do to a team, any team, not just Tip, like the goal threat they have, like 10 goals in the last two games, 15 goal chances created. If they do start banging in and raising green flags, it's very hard to get back at them. So I think Tip will be hoping, Shane. No goals in the first half anyway for Cork, and you never know then what could happen after that. But and if it becomes a shootout, I think there's only one winner in no matter who's playing Cork in the shootout, and I think that's Cork. But if you take the game to them physically and try to close down that space as best you can, I think Tip will have a great chance. Like.
Are Cork at championship levels of intensity already, or are they still holding a few people or a few tactics or a bit of energy in reserve?
I think that they're hurling very, very well in comparison maybe to a lot of teams. And I think even what they learned from the night they played Tip in the league earlier on, dear Shane, that night they scored one goal, but they had six very, very good goal chances. And I think that was a big thing they worked on since then. As you said, 10 goals scored in the last two matches. So what are they holding that back? I think maybe with the puck outs, we haven't seen them maybe go very, very long. That they went very short, or they went short last time against Galway. So, and I suppose you're asking the question to teams, Shane, to say, if you push on us, there's going to leave space. And if your half-back line push on us, Patrick Collins could have in the locker to go 90, 100 yards and hit a 40, 50-yard gap that's left by pushing on teams. And if you give that space to Brian Hayes, Patrick Horgan, Jack O'Connor, Alan Connolly, these kind of guys, we see the hurt, see the damage that they can cause. So maybe they're holding that back. But as regards intensity and everything, I think they're going at this hard. I think they really want to win it. 1998, last time they won it. It's been 17 years since Tip won the league. So I think you've two groups of people, Shane, who, as groups on a whole, like none of the Cork lads have a national medal as senior Cork hurlers. And like a majority of the tip lads have no medals at all as tip senior hurlers. So I think are they going to go for it? I think 100% they're both going to go for it. Because at the end of the day, you know, when you look back in your time, you want to have a few medals to show for the effort you put in. And here's a massive chance for everyone to win one Sunday. Like,
is there anything in particular Liam Cahill has discovered about this group that perhaps we haven't seen in the recent past?
Well, I suppose, I think he really has consistently stuck with the lads who've played well, Shane, right? Mm. And he's developed a spine of the team, right, where, say, Barry Hogan, for me, would be the goalie. And then you'd be looking at Owen Connolly at 3, Ronan Maher at 6, Craig Morgan would be the Colours midfield, Jake Morris at 11, and Darren McCarthy at 14, or Jason Ford. And he's kind of stuck with that. And those guys have played most, if not all, the league games and seen most, if not all, league time. And then you're building guys in around it. And whoever comes in and gets their chance, and if they take it, he's given them the chance the next day. And he's basically said to them, you keep the jersey for as long as you deserve to keep the jersey. And if you look at, like, even Robert Doyle, a cornerback, he's got his chance. He's come in. He's taken it with both hands. And he will start at the weekend. And he will be a championship starter as well. So, and then I suppose a lot of these lads are unknowns in the wider hurling world. They'd be known very well in tape or, you know, within the colleges, hurling and things like that. But that for me is what Liam Cahill has done. He has stuck with the lads. He's not maybe worried about burnout or lads playing too many matches for a championship. Whoever's playing well, they play. And I think whoever plays well Sunday, they'll almost be guaranteed that they'll be starting in 3 weeks' time in championship against Limerick too, Shane.
Well, there'll be two teams going full pelt and looking to get that springboard into the Munster Championship. The curtain raiser to all of that is the showdown of Waterford and Offaly. Shane, there'll be a bit of needle to this considering how the recent league encounter went in Welsh Park, you'd imagine.
Yeah, there will. And I say during the week, James Mahan, like, I mean, there was yellow cards that could have been reds, and there was a red card that probably wasn't even a yellow, you know, when you look back in it. But there will be a bit. Like, I think Offaly weren't at full tilt, and in their mindset too, Shane, was they were qualified for the league final. So they didn't have to really get anything out of the Waterford game. But at the same time, I think it shows the progression they've made and where they're at now in that, you know, they were qualified for that, didn't have their full strength team, and still Waterford had it all through to get the result against them. Now, they pulled away for a finish, but, I mean, let's be honest, like, when James Mahan gets sent off, the game becomes different. A lot of space opens up for the likes of Daisy Hutchison and these guys. So there was a bit of needle in it. There was a few strokes in it as well. I said a lot of cards shown. So I don't think there's a rivalry between them. But, I mean, for me, like, I thought the league final was going to be Waterford and Dublin, and I think a lot of people did. But, it just shows where Offaly are at. And as I said, there's a few guys to bring back into the fold. They'll have, you know, 15 players. I think the big learning for them was, you know, regardless of who's his first match back or not, Tadhg Na Burka is the best in the country at playing that sweeper role or mopping up that space or cutting out space when he has to. He was man of the match from the last day. And I think Johnny Kelly and the management team, the big learning for them is they're going to have to avoid him, or else if they're going at him, they just have to go at it hard. Hammer to hammer, as the saying goes before, like, really go at it hard and turn him over. But for me, I'd just be saying, we have hurlers, we're hurling really well. We've ball players all over the field. They have as good as inside forward line Offaly have as any intercounty team in the country, in the form of Brian Dygan and Charlie Mitchell, and Stan Ravenhill starts in there as well. So I'd be saying, let's hit the space in front of these guys, use the ball and try and avoid Tadhg Na Burka and not let him be man of the match. Because if Tadhg Na Burka has that influence again, Shane, it goes a long way to Waterford being successful. But like, I suppose, like Tip and their spine, I think Waterford has a really, really good spine of their team. Mark Fitz at full, Tadhg Na Burka at centre. If you've Desi at 14, and if you've Jamie Barron is hurling out with skin at centre forward. So they're getting lads back at the right time rather than losing them. But I just feel, with all that being said, I think Offaly are, they've got great momentum. There'll be no fear. And I think they'll go down and just really have a real cut off this. And I actually fancy them to maybe win the game, Shane.
Okay. Well, on that bombshell, Shane McGrath, we'll leave the conversation there. Should be two cracking hurling matches this Sunday. Thank you so much for taking the call. As I mentioned, Waterford Offaly, 1:45 before Cork Tipperary at 4:00.
Game on. Association football.
We are rounding out the show chatting association football. I did promise a bit of rugby preview with Bernie Jackman, but we decided to push that tomorrow because, you know, we'll have a bit of team news tomorrow. So it will be even more insightful, our rugby preview with Andrew O'Connor in the hot seat tomorrow. Paul Corrie in football news. Before we chat Premier League, well, it is related to Premier League. Arsenal defender Gabriel will miss the remainder of the season after the club confirmed he requires a hamstring surgery. Massive blow with an eye on the Champions League, of course.
Yeah, big blow. Not so much from a Premier League perspective. They're most likely going to finish in that second position. But when you think of going deep in the Champions League, you really need that centre-half partnership of Gabriel and Saliba. And they have been such a formidable presence for Arsenal that when either one of them has been injured, they just don't have the same strength and depth to kind of plug the gap. So it will be another case for Arteta. They were obviously missing Saka. They had to move players about. You would imagine with Gabriel being out injured, probably going to have to bring in Timber in as a centre-half and try kind of make up the numbers from there. But yeah, huge, huge loss when you consider a Champions League run.
Last night in the Premier League, City defeated Leicester 2-0. Newcastle, an absolute cracker from Tonali, 2-1. Villa, Marcus Rashford in a bit of form, 3-0 win away to Brighton. Bournemouth lost at home to Ipswich, 2-1. Southampton nearly got a rare win, denied by late equaliser against Crystal Palace. However, the Merseyside derby, 1-0 to Liverpool, grinding out a 1-0 derby win, a sign of champion mentality, Paul.
Yeah, listen, it wasn't Liverpool at their free-flowing best, and they probably haven't been, I don't think, Shane, since that first leg in Paris Saint-Germain. I thought that sort of bamboozled them and it threw them off then in the Champions League and ultimately in the League Cup final. But it didn't really matter about the man of the performance. It was all about the 3 points. And they've such a big gap now between themselves and Arsenal that they probably don't need to be at their best over the coming weeks and months. You know, they've enough fixtures there that they could pick up 3 points and almost canter to the line. But it was really important, I think, just from a morale and momentum perspective to get back to winning ways. A lot of the talk was around the Tarkowski tackle. I mean, it was absolutely dreadful. I don't know how. I mean, we're giving out about League of Ireland officials last week. They don't have the benefit of VAR.
Like, thank God they came out and apologised. But yeah, how do you get to that stage?
I genuinely don't know how you missed that. It was terrible. It was such a bad tackle. He knew exactly what he was doing.
He apologised at the end. I saw there's pictures going over to McAllister. You could see that.
And David Moyes is obviously a little bit annoyed about the Liverpool goal. And I tend to agree with him. I don't think the rules...
It's like laws of the game, he's onside. But common sense, he's offside.
No, not onside. Not interfering with play.
Sorry, yeah. But common sense.
Tarkowski doesn't go for the ball in the manner that he does and doesn't take that touch if Diaz isn't standing behind him.
Absolutely.
So he is, in my mind, interfering with play, but the rules of the game will suggest it's not. Yeah. So, listen, it's so hard to keep up with all of these different changes, and particularly from an offside perspective. But Jota took his goal really well. Beto caused the two centre-halves a lot of problems. I mean, Van Dijk and Konate looked very ropey at different moments last night. And if he'd taken that chance in the first half when he'd pulled against the post, it might have been a different story. But Liverpool looking, you know, as if, like I mentioned, they're going to canter to the line at this race.
Bad news for Arsenal fans, because should Liverpool and Arsenal continue to cancel each other out with wins every week, the earliest Liverpool could be confirmed as champions would be the fixture against Chelsea at Stamford Bridge on May 4th. Their next match would be against Arsenal, so perhaps a guard of honour might be on show. Speaking of Chelsea Spurs this evening, what excites you about that fixture? Impartially now, Paul.
Yeah, well, it's not been a brilliant season for many reasons for Tottenham, but a win against Chelsea could certainly try build some sort of momentum. I was just looking at kind of the form table within the Premier League, Shane. In the last 20 games, bear in mind that Tottenham played 29, only Ipswich, Leicester and Southampton have picked up less points. That is a terrible, terrible statistic to have against your name. And for Chelsea,
That's incredible.
Yeah, only the bottom three teams have less points. If Chelsea are serious about Champions League football, given the stat that I've just rhymed off, you have to beat Tottenham at home.
Yeah.
Looking at the lineups there, the kind of centre-half partnership always worries me with Chelsea. Chalobah and Louis Colwill, I think you can get at the two of them. But at the top end of the pitch, Jackson comes back into the team. Cole Palmer's back in. Jadon Sancho, Neto, Fernandes. If you can get it to click, Chelsea are a brilliant side going forward, but they always, always, always give you a chance at the other end of the pitch. So it should be an open game, Shane. Two managers like to attack. Two teams who are probably at their best when they're going forward. So I'd expect a couple of chances, a couple of goals.
Okay. Final word, very briefly. Tonali said it was a 70% cross, a 30% shot. Did he mean it?
Yeah, I got to go. it was pretty honest. Yeah,
footballers sticking up for footballers. Okay, we'll leave the conversation there. Paul Corrie, thank you so much for popping into the studio. Big thanks to Andrew and Laura Lee working on this evening's show. That is all we have time for. As I mentioned, we will be previewing the Champions Cup tomorrow. Andrew O'Connor will take you through the Eurosport from 6 to 7. Beto da Silva is up next after we check in with the news desk. So do not go anywhere. From all of the team here at Game On, good evening.